from Elmhurst Public Library. This is Storytime for Grown-Ups. I am Margie Kohlbacher. Welcome to Episode 9. Stories have the power to inspire and change us. Being read to stimulates our brains, expands our imaginations, and is just plain fun. Today, we're going to experience a breadth of tone, from dry wit to disturbing. For our first selection, I'm pleased to introduce our special guest reader, Cheryl Rice. Cheryl will read My Life with R.H. Macy. It's an essay written by Shirley Jackson. You most likely know of Shirley Jackson from her short story, The Lottery. But today's piece has a very different tone as she regales us with her brief stint working in the world of retail. Then Duard Mosley will read another story by Shirley Jackson called The Witch. This story demonstrates Jackson's ability to blend wit with a tone of unease. Finally, we'll cap today's podcast with a tale by horror master H.P. Lovecraft called The Terrible Old Man. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
My Life with R.H. Macy by Shirley Jackson. And the first thing they did was segregate me. They segregated me from the only person in the place I had even a speaking acquaintance with. That was a girl I had met going down the hall who said to me, "Are you as scared as I am?" And when I said yes, she said, "I'm in lingerie. What are you in?" And I thought for a while and then said, "Spun glass," which was as good an answer as I could think of. And she said, "Oh, well, I'll meet you here in a sec." And she went away and was segregated, and I never saw her again. Then they kept calling my name, and I kept trotting over to wherever they called it, and they would say, they, all this time, being startlingly beautiful young women in tailored suits and with short-clipped hair, "Go with Miss Cooper here. She'll tell you what to do." All the women I met on my first day were named Miss Cooper, and Miss Cooper would say to me, "What are you in?" And I had learned by that time to say, "Books." And she would say, "Oh, well, then you belong with Miss Cooper here." And then she would call, "Miss Cooper." And another young woman would come, and the first one would say, "13-3138 here belongs with you." And Miss Cooper would say, "What is she in?" And Miss Cooper would answer, "Books." And I would go away and be segregated again. Then they taught me. They finally got me segregated into a classroom, and I sat there for a while all by myself. That's how far segregated I was. And then a few other girls came in, all wearing tailored suits. I was wearing a red velvet afternoon frock. And we sat down, and they taught us. They gave us each a big book with R.H. Macy written on it. And inside this book were pads of little sheets saying, from left to right, "Comp, keep for ref, cust, DA no, or CT no, sales book no, sales check no, clerk no, department, date M." After M, there was a long line for Mr. or Mrs. and the name, and then it began again with no item, class, at price, total. And down at the bottom was written original, and then again, "Comp, keep for ref, and paste yellow gift stamp here." I read this all very carefully. Pretty soon a Miss Cooper came, who talked for a little while on the advantages we had in working at Macy's, and she talked about the sales books, which it seems came apart into sort of a road map and carbons and things. I listened for a while, and when Miss Cooper wanted us to write on the little pieces of paper, I copied from the girl next to me. That was training. Finally, someone said we were going on the floor, and we descended from the 16th floor to the first. We were in groups of six by then, all following Miss Cooper doggedly and wearing little tags saying, "Book information." I never did find out what that meant. Miss Cooper said I had to work on the special sale counter and showed me a little book called The Stage Struck Seal, which it seemed I would be selling. I had gotten about halfway through it before she came back to tell me I had to stay with my unit. I enjoyed meeting the time clock and spent a pleasant half hour punching various cards standing around. And then someone came in and said I couldn't punch the clock with my hat on. So I had to leave, bowing timidly at the time clock and its prophet, and I went and found out my locker number, which was 1773, and my time clock number, which was 712, and my cash box number, which was 1336, and my cash register number, which was 253, and my cash register drawer number, which was K, and my cash register drawer key number, which was 872, and my department number, which was 13. I wrote all these numbers down. And that was my first day. My second day was better. I was officially on the floor. I stood in a corner of a counter with one hand possessively on the stage-struck seal, waiting for customers. The counter head was named 13-2246, and she was very kind to me. She sent me to lunch three times because she got me confused with 13-6454 and 13-3141. It was after lunch that a customer came. She came over and took one of my stage-struck seals and said, "How much is this?" I opened my mouth, and the customer said, "I have a DA, and I will have this sent to my aunt in Ohio. Part of that DA I will pay for with a book dividend of 32 cents, and the rest, of course, will be on my account. Is this book price fixed?" That's as near as I can remember what she said. I smiled confidently and said, "Certainly, will you wait just one moment?" I found a little piece of paper in a drawer under the counter. It had duplicate, triplicate printed across the front in big letters. I took down the customer's name and address, her aunt's name and address, and wrote carefully across the front of the duplicate, triplicate, one stage-struck seal. Then I smiled at the customer again and said carelessly, "That will be 75 cents. She said, "But I have a DA. I told her that all DAs were suspended for the Christmas rush, and she gave me 75 cents, which I kept. Then I rang up a no sale on the cash register, and I tore up the duplicate triplicate because I didn't know what else to do with it. Later on, another customer came and said, "Where would I find a copy of Anne Rutherford Gwynne's He Came Like Thunder?" And I said, "In medical books, right across the way." But 13-2246 came and said, "That's philosophy, isn't it?" And the customer said it was. And 13-2246 said, "Right down this aisle, in dictionaries." The customer went away, and I said to 13-2246 that her guess was as good as mine anyway. And she stared at me and explained that philosophy, social sciences, and Bertrand Russell were all kept in dictionaries. When I asked her why, she said vaguely that they sold about the same. So far, I haven't been back to Macy's for my third day because that night when I started to leave the store, I fell down the stairs and tore my stockings, and the doorman said that if I went to my department head, Macy's would give me a new pair of stockings. And I went back and I found Miss Cooper, and she said, "Go to the adjuster on the 7th floor and give him this." And she handed me a little slip of pink paper, and on the bottom of it was printed, "Comp, keep for ref, cust, DA no, or CT no, sales book no, sales check no, clerk no, dept, date M." And after M, instead of a name, she had written 13-3138. I took the little pink slip and threw it away and went up to the 4th floor and bought myself another pair of stockings for 69 cents. And then I came down and went out the customer's entrance. I wrote Macy's a long letter, and I signed it with all of my numbers added together and divided by 11,700, which is the number of employees in Macy's. I wonder if they miss me.
The Witch by Shirley Jackson. The coach was so nearly empty that the little boy had a seat all to himself, and his mother sat across the aisle on the seat next to the little boy's sister, a baby with a piece of toast in one hand and a rattle in the other. She was strapped securely to the seat so she could sit up and look around. And whenever she began to slip slowly sideways, the strap caught her and held her halfway until her mother turned around and straightened her again. The little boy was looking out the window and eating a cookie, and the mother was reading quietly, answering the little boy's questions without looking up. "We're on a river," the little boy said. "This is a river, and we're on it." "Fine," his mother said. "We're on a bridge over a river," the little boy said to himself. The few other people in the coach were sitting at the other end of the car. If any of them had occasion to come down the aisle, the little boy would look around and say, "Hi," and the stranger would usually say, "Hi," back, and sometimes ask the little boy if he were enjoying the train ride, or even tell him he was a fine big fellow. These comments annoyed the little boy, and he would turn irritably back to the window. "There's a cow," he would say, or sighing, "How far do we have to go?" "Not much longer now," his mother said each time. Once the baby, who was very quiet and busy with her rattle and toast, which the mother would renew constantly, fell over too far sideways and banged her head. She began to cry, and for a minute there was noise and movement around the mother's seat. The little boy slid down from his own seat and ran across the aisle to pet his sister's feet and beg her not to cry. And finally, the baby laughed and went back to her toast. And the little boy received a lollipop from his mother and went back to the window. "I saw a witch," he said to his mother after another minute. "There was a big old, ugly old, bad old witch outside." "Fine," his mother said. "A big old ugly witch, and I told her to go away, and she went away," the little boy went on in a quiet narrative to himself. "She came and said, 'I'm going to eat you up.' And I said, 'No, you're not.' And I chased her away, the bad, old, mean witch." He stopped talking and looked up as the outside door of the coach opened, and a man came in. He was an elderly man with a pleasant face under white hair. His blue suit was only faintly touched by the disarray that comes from a long train trip. He was carrying a cigar, and when the little boy said, "Hi," the man gestured at him with his cigar and said, "Hello yourself, son." He stopped just beside the little boy's seat and leaned against the back, looking down at the little boy, who craned his neck to look upward. "What are you looking for out that window?" the man asked.
"Witches," the little boy said promptly. "Bad old mean witches."
"I see," the man said. "Find many?"
"My father smokes cigars," the little boy said.
"All men smoke cigars," the man said. "Someday you'll smoke a cigar too."
"I'm a man already," the little boy said.
"How old are you?" the man asked.
The little boy at the eternal question looked at the man suspiciously for a minute and then said,
26, 848.
His mother lifted her head from the book.
"4, she said, smiling fondly at the little boy. "Is that so?" the man said politely to the little boy. 26. He nodded his head at the mother across the aisle. "Is that your mother?"
The little boy leaned forward to look, and then said,
"Yes, that's her."
"What's your name?" the man asked.
The little boy looked suspicious again.
"Mr. Jesus," he said.
"Johnny," the little boy's mother said. She caught the little boy's eye and frowned deeply.
"That's my sister over there," the little boy said to the man. "She's 12 and a half.
"Do you love your sister?" the man asked.
The little boy stared, and the man came around the side of the seat and sat down next to the little boy.
"Listen," the man said, "shall I tell you about my little sister?"
The mother, who had looked up anxiously when the man sat down next to her little boy, went peacefully back to her book.
"Tell me about your sister," the little boy said.
"Was she a witch?"
"Maybe," the man said. The little boy laughed excitedly, and the man leaned back and puffed at his cigar.
"Once upon a time," he began, "I had a little sister just like yours."
Little boy looked up at the man, nodding at every word.
"My little sister," the man went on, "was so pretty and so nice that I loved her more than anything else in the world. So, shall I tell you what I did?"
The little boy nodded more vehemently, and the mother lifted her eyes from her book and smiled, listening.
"I bought her a rocking horse and a doll and a million lollipops," the man said. "And then I took her and I put my hands around her neck and I pinched her and I pinched her until she was dead."
The little boy gasped, and the mother turned around, her smile fading. She opened her mouth and then closed it again as the man went on.
And then I took and I cut her head off. And I took her head.
Did you cut her all in pieces?
The little boy asked breathlessly.
I cut off her head and her hands and her feet and her hair and her nose, the man said. And I hit her with a stick and I killed her.
Wait a minute, the mother said. But the baby fell over sideways just at that minute, and by the time the mother had set her up again, the man was going on.
And I took her head, and I pulled out her hair, and...
Your little sister?
The little boy prompted eagerly.
My little sister, the man said firmly. And I put her head in a cage with a bear, and the bear ate it all up.
Ate her head all up?
The little boy asked. The mother put her book down and came across the aisle. She stood next to the man and said,
Just what do you think you're doing?
The man looked up courteously and she said, Get out of here.
Did I frighten you? The man said.
He looked down at the little boy and nudged him with an elbow, and he and the little boy laughed.
This man cut up his little sister,
the little boy said to his mother. I can very easily call the conductor, the mother said to the man.
The conductor will eat my mommy,
the little boy said.
We'll chop her head off.
And little sister's head, too, the man said.
He stood up, and the mother stood back to let him get out of the seat.
Don't ever come back in this car, she said.
My mommy will eat you,
the little boy said to the man. The man laughed, and the little boy laughed. And then the man said, Excuse me, to the mother, and went past her out of the car. When the door had closed behind him, the little boy said,
How much longer do we have to stay on this old train?
Not much longer, the mother said. She stood looking at the little boy, wanting to say something, and finally she said, You sit still and be a good boy. You may have another lollipop. The little boy climbed down eagerly and followed his mother back to her seat. She took a lollipop from a bag in her pocketbook and gave it to him. What do you say? She asked.
Thank you, the little boy said. Did that man really cut his little sister up in pieces?
He was just teasing, the mother said, and added urgently,
Just teasing.
Probably, the little boy said. With his lollipop, he went back to his own seat and settled himself to look out the window again.
Probably he was a witch.
The Terrible Old Man by H.P. Lovecraft. It was the design of Angelo Ricci and Joe Chanek and Manuel Silva to call on the Terrible Old Man. This old man dwells all alone in a very ancient house on Water Street, near the sea. It is reputed to be both exceedingly rich and exceedingly feeble, which forms a situation very attractive to men of the profession of Messrs. Ricci, Chanek, and Silva, for that profession was nothing less dignified than robbery. The inhabitants of Kingsport say and think many things about the Terrible Old Man, which generally keep him safe from the attention of gentlemen like Mr. Ricci and his colleagues, despite the almost certain fact that he hides a fortune of indefinite magnitude somewhere about his musty and venerable abode. He is, in truth, a very strange person, believed to have been a captain of East India clipper ships in his day, so old that no one can remember when he was young, and so taciturn that few know his real name. Among the gnarled trees in the front yard of his aged and neglected place, he maintains a strange collection of large stones, oddly grouped and painted so that they resemble the idols in some obscure Eastern temple. This collection frightens away most of the small boys, who love to taunt the Terrible Old Man about his long white hair and beard, or to break the small paned windows of his dwelling with wicked missiles. But there are other things which frighten the older and more curious folk who sometimes steal up to the house to peer in through the dusty panes. These folks say that on a table in a bare room on the ground floor are many peculiar bottles, in each a small piece of lead suspended pendulum-wise from a string. And they say that the terrible old man talks to these bottles, addressing them by such names as Jack, Scarface, Long Tom, Spanish Joe, Peters, and Mate Ellis. And that whenever he speaks to a bottle, the little lead pendulum within makes certain definite vibrations as if in answer. Those who have watched the tall, lean, terrible old man in these peculiar conversations do not watch him again. But Angelo Ricci and Joe Chanik and Manuel Silva were not of Kingsport blood. They were of that new and heterogeneous alien stock which lies outside the charmed circle of New England life and traditions. They saw in the terrible old man merely a tottering, almost helpless graybeard, who could not walk without the aid of his knotted cane, and whose thin, weak hands shook pitifully. They were really quite sorry in their way for the lonely, unpopular old fellow, whom everybody shunned, and at whom all the dogs barked singularly. But business is business, and to a robber whose soul is in his profession, there is a lure and a challenge about a very old and very feeble man who has no account at the bank and who pays for his few necessities at the village store with Spanish gold and silver minted 2 centuries ago. Messrs. Ricci, Chanik, and Silva selected the night of April 11th for their call. Mr. Ricci and Mr. Silva were to interview the poor old gentleman while Mr. Chanik waited for them and their presumable metallic burden with a covered motor car in Ship Street by the gate in the tall rear wall of their host grounds. Desire to avoid needless explanations in case of unexpected police intrusions prompted these plans for a quiet and unostentatious departure. As prearranged, the three adventurers started out separately in order to prevent any evil-minded suspicions afterwards. Messrs. Ricci and Silva met in Water Street by the old man's front gate. And although they did not like the way the moon shone down upon the painted stones through the budding branches of the gnarled trees, they had more important things to think about than mere idle superstition. They feared it might be unpleasant work making the terrible old man loquacious concerning his hoarded gold and silver. For aged sea captains are notably stubborn and perverse. Still, he was very old and very feeble, and there were 2 visitors. Messrs. Ricci and Silva were experienced in the art of making unwilling persons voluble. And the screams of a weak and exceptionally vulnerable man can be easily muffled. So they moved up to the one lighted window and heard the terrible old man talking childishly to his bottles with pendulums. Then they donned masks and knocked politely at the weather-stained oaken door. Waiting seemed very long to Mr. Chanik as he fidgeted restlessly in the covered motor car by the terrible old man's back gate in Ship Street. He was more than ordinarily tender-hearted, and he did not like the hideous screams he had heard in the ancient house just after the hour appointed for the deed. Had he not told his colleagues to be as gentle as possible with the pathetic old sea captain? Very nervously, he watched that narrow oaken gate in the high and ivy-clad stone wall. Frequently, he consulted his watch and wondered at the delay. Had the old man died before revealing where his treasure was hidden? And had a thorough search become necessary? Mr. Chanik did not like to wait so long in the dark in such a place. Then he sensed a soft tread or tapping on the walk inside the gate, heard a gentle fumbling at the rusty latch, and saw the narrow, heavy door swing inward. And in the pallid glow of the single dim street lamp, he strained his eyes to see what his colleagues had brought out of that sinister house which loomed so close behind. But when he looked, he did not see what he had expected, for his colleagues were not there at all, but only the terrible old man, leaning quietly on his knotted cane and smiling hideously. Mr. Chanik had never before noticed the color of that man's eyes. Now he saw that they were yellow. Little things make considerable excitement in little towns, which is the reason that Kingsport people talked all that spring and summer about the three unidentifiable bodies, horribly slashed as with many cutlasses and horribly mangled as by the tread of many cruel boot heels, which the tide washed in. And some people even spoke of things as trivial as the deserted motor car found in Ship Street, or certain especially inhuman cries, probably of a stray animal or migratory bird heard in the night by wakeful citizens. But in this idle village gossip, the terrible old man took no interest at all. He was by nature reserved. And when one is aged and feeble, one's reserve is doubly strong. Besides, so ancient a sea captain must have witnessed scores of things much more stirring in the far-off days of his unremembered youth.
Thank you for listening today. Be sure to join us for our next episode of Mind Expanding Tales.
Storytime for Grownups is recorded at Elmhurst Public Library's Creative Studio Lab. Our director and editor is Josh Jers, our producer and host is Margie Colewalker, and our stories today were narrated by Duard Mosley. Works read in this podcast may be protected under copyright law. These podcasts are reserved for the education of library patrons only. Elmhurst Public Library receives no commercial gain from these recordings. No unauthorized further dissemination of these works is permitted.